take a network break. It's swimsuit season, so today's episode is brought to you by Virtual Kale. Virtual Kale meets your daily requirements for fiber, antioxidants, and self-righteousness. I'm Drew Conry Murray. Greg Farrow is here. This is our weekly review of analysis and tech news. You like that?
Kale from your social media diet. Is that what you're telling me?
That's right. Everybody needs a little. We got to switch from virtual donuts to kale
now. Virtual bottles and sell it on our sell it virtually. Do you think?
Oh yeah, kale juice is coming. Virtual kale juice.
That's virtual kale juice and in special pill form. Maybe we can get it in a suppository form for certain people who need
all
it.
All your nostrums, yeah. Right here.
Just as a hint.
We'll have to talk about that in our product meeting. I don't know.
Yeah, that's right.
Today's episode is sponsored in part by Thousand Eyes. Thousand Eyes gives you performance visibility from every user to every app over any network, both internal and external, so you can smoothly migrate to the cloud, transform your WAN, troubleshoot faster, and deliver exceptional user experience. You can sign up for a free account at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers and choose a free Thousand Eyes t-shirt. And the Packet Pushers have also launched a new membership site. That's at ignition.packetpushers.net. It's got exclusive content for professional development, and there's free and paid tiers. Check it out at ignition.packetpushers.net. And Greg, you have an update on SSL.
Yeah, we've been enabling the Packet Pushers website this week, so it's all flipped over to be TLS ready for when the Chrome apocalypse. So Chrome is going to start reporting that HTTP sites are unsafe. Of course, that's nice for Google because then nobody can intercept your traffic as it crosses the internet and inject ads, which is something that people have been doing. So part of SSL enabling too is also to get better performance. We're going to wait a week or so, and then I'm going to start enabling SSL on the Podcatcher feed. So if you notice something going wrong in the weeks ahead with your subscription with the network break or whatever, email me. We're at packetpushers@gmail.com and let me know if there's problems on your thing. It's possible that if you're using an older Podcatcher that we found when we last did this a year ago, a lot of podcatchers just didn't support SSL and just stopped working. So maybe if you've got an older podcatcher, now's the time to think about switching over to Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or some other more modern, I recommend Overcast on iOS, and people have a large range of recommendations on Android. But maybe switch up for one of those would be a good thing because anything that's been updated recently should be SSL ready. And that gets us into the future where we want it to be.
Yeah, we found out the hard way that SSL broke some podcaster feeds.
I think it took me like 80 hours of work all night and all weekends to try and debug that problem last time around. It was dreadful and we lost it. It caused a lot of problems. So there's that. And then also we migrated Ignition to new hosting last night. It's screaming fast now. It's excitingly fast.
Yeah, the first hoster we landed on was not good, and now we've updated. And yeah, so if you've been to Ignition and found it a little pokey, try it again. We've got a new hoster.
That's right. It's blisteringly fast. Thank goodness for SSDs. The actual hosting platform's half the size, but it's on SSDs. So it's like 10, 20, 30 times faster. It's nice. Quite amazing. And in the weeks ahead, we are migrating the Packet Pushers website. So it's all about infrastructure this summer here at Packet Pushers. So hopefully you don't even notice anything, but we are making improvements to the website, which positions us ready for the next, well, hopefully the next 5 years.
That's right.
That's about it. Yeah. It's really been quite painful, but we're on our way.
All right. You're here for the news, not to hear about the internal workings of Packet Pushers. So let's go.
But what's important to me is what's important, isn't it?
You are not the center of the universe.
Yeah. What I'm doing is the most important.
All right, the big story for this week, chipmaker Broadcom surprised, I think, everybody in the tech industry by announcing that it intended to buy CA Technologies for $18.9 billion. If you don't know about CA Technologies, they've been around forever. They sell software for mainframes, and they do IT enterprise solutions like systems management, security, and ID management.
I think it's fair to say that CA Technologies is, for most people in enterprise IT today, will be like, huh, who?
Yes.
But back in my day, CA was like the big beast of software development, and they had a whole bunch. And then there was a period through the 90s where they were buying up companies that were failing. So they would buy products that had reached the end of their life and then turn them into rent extraction. They would buy things like various database products and accounting products and then just put them on life support, you know, maintain patches and do the bare minimum that you need to iterate forward. But still taking maintenance on products that are basically end of life, but you know, enterprises haven't thrown them out the door yet or worked up the guts to change them up to something new.
Right.
So for Broadcom, you know, and I was watching on the Twitters and following what people were saying, and CA is not exactly loved. Let's just say that amongst the tweet that I saw, it's like CA, those bunch of, you know, whatever's, that software is still rubbish. Why you would want to buy a second-rate company, whatever. I mean, $19 billion is not a rubbish company.
$19 billion is a lot of money, of money, which I think is why, well, for one, why is a chip maker buying a legacy software company is one, and two, why are they putting that premium on it?
Well, the premium's not much. A 20% premium for a buyout's fairly reasonable.
That's
not
true.
Paying over the years.
Yeah.
CA earned $4.2 billion in revenue, so it's a four and a half times multiple.
Mm-hmm.
So not a huge, you know, it's not like it's an Amazon, which is like on 100 times
right.
ratio. So it's not like that. The general consensus appears to be that Broadcom is desperate to spend money. It's got a whole bunch of money in a war chest that it's leveraged up because it was trying to buy Qualcomm. So it had a whole lot of stuff going on.
Yep.
It's made a business out of acquisitions. It's done hundreds of acquisitions over the last 10 years, and some of them are really quite substantial. I made a blog post on this a while back, but just like acquiring a company after company, you know, Brocade, for example, they bought the Brocade Fiber Channel business and then just ditched all the bits they didn't want, you know, basically gave them away. It's kind of the way I saw it.
Right.
So I think Broadcom might just be a business which is desperate to do acquisitions. And one of the things is over the years, we've seen companies who make continuous acquisitions and fold them in usually blow up at some point. They get very wrong.
Sure.
Because they keep trying to put things together. But like, look at General Electric, you know, 10 years of amazing. Everybody was saying how fantastic General, you know, they were doing washing machines and nuclear reactors and, you know, all the different things. But they blew up, right? At some point, it just all comes tumbling down because you can't have all of these disparate things running together. And if Broadcom's going down the conglomerate model like Samsung or whatever, well, that becomes, you've then got to believe that the executive team's actually able to juggle balls in the air and hold them all up. And
right. The word I've been reading in the coverage is people are looking for, is there a synergy here? And the general consensus in my own analysis is no, there's not.
No. There's no synergy between a chip maker, you know, literally somebody who designs and manufactures chips, which is what Broadcom does, and somebody who makes software for a living and usually old, tired, retired software.
Right. CA gets most of its revenue from selling mainframe software.
Yeah. So, you know, mainframes aren't dead. Legacy networks aren't dead. You know, all the innovations we talk about on this show, yes. But the answer is a lot of that legacy technology sticks around. Although public cloud is likely to make a bigger dent in mainframes, I think, in time.
Mm-hmm.
As, you know, it promotes a more orchestrated way of working and people will let go 30 or 40-year-old technologies. Sort of be forced to, I think, as the cost systems change around. But it's just, you know, there's nothing about this deal which is really standing out except the fact that there's no synergy whatsoever. The flip side is if Broadcom wants to grow and it is and it wants to and it has money because it missed the buyout of Qualcomm, where do you go?
Right. And that's I've read a couple of different perspectives on this, that they're essentially shut out of buying any other chip maker because of regulatory restrictions.
Well, there's no one to buy.
And there's no one to buy.
Cavium and Marvell are merging, you know.
Yeah.
Marvell's buying Cavium. You know, it's got to be a big deal. Like Broadcom is not a small company. It's a huge company. So it can't be like a $500 million here or a billion here. It's got to be a $10, $20 billion purchase to move the needle.
Right. And I also wonder if, you know, like we talked about this when they acquired Brocade, there were issues of, are they going to get into some issues with their own customers about competing against them? So those kind of concerns may also be locking them out from other acquisitions that may be a little bit closer and have more synergy with their core business. Like essentially, I think they're staying away from the entire networking space for that kind of reason. They don't want to get into, you know, competing with their own customers. So it does sort of really limit their options if they're out there to acquire.
Well, I guess that, yes, there's not a lot out there for them to buy. This is an odd choice, though. This seems to be quite unusual.
It's a very odd choice.
If they were buying something which was a bit more modern and a bit more fancy, well, then, you know, maybe people would be, you know, like Cisco's only $50 billion. Why not buy that?
Right.
You know, they could, because right. That was Qualcomm. Qualcomm was that size of a deal. Why don't they go and buy Cisco?
Yeah.
So, you know, they could do these things, but I think that Broadcom's basically struggling for cash flow. They've got a bunch of businesses which are a long time in building. They bought Broadcom and then started to churn out astonishing amounts of cash from the Fiber Channel business. Right, effectively, in Brocade, they bought a legacy business that's going to last for another 10 to 20 years and basically just sell the product, you know?
Right.
Get out there, keep it on slide, and just take all the profit out of it you can.
Exactly. And I'm sure that's what they're thinking with CA Technologies.
Mm-hmm.
It's a low growth business, but it's a high margin business, and maybe they can also get a few more margin points by shaving off some duplicate functions, like some executive level and some HR functions and so on, and just squeeze a little bit more money out of that stone.
You don't always buy companies for synergy. Sometimes you buy them just for financial engineering.
Yeah, just for the cash and financial engineering, yes.
I can buy this company and it'll return me, you know, X amount of, you know, X billions of dollars in cash flow per year. Well, I can use that to pay down the debt that I've built up buying these high growth businesses. And maybe you do it for that reason. Who knows?
Right.
You just have to – the general consensus is that most people are going to trust Broadcom's executives to make this work. I'm not so sure.
Based on the reaction in the market, people aren't necessarily trusting them to make this work, because was it something like $15 billion got taken off the stock price at the announcement?
Yeah, stock fell from 242 to 209, which is a 52-week low. Bounced back up a little bit this morning. I think people are trying to take some, you know, trying to get back in and saying it's an opportunity to buy.
Yeah.
But I think for enterprise IT, this kind of stuff doesn't really matter. Broadcom's so big, it can't really fail. But if something does go wrong, then it does affect us, because our access to Broadcom ASICs is an issue. Keep in mind that Broadcom is the dominant Ethernet ASIC company today for just about all vendors. You know, Cavium and Marvell have given up and merged, so maybe they can bring out an ASIC. We've got the Tofino, but that's still a small, you know, not exactly the operating, it's a minnow compared to what Broadcom is doing. And going to be interesting to see what happens if something does go wrong. And that's my concern with this in the enterprise IT space. If Broadcom comes unstuck, there's an awful lot of Ethernet technology in NICs and switches and routers and home routers that suddenly goes into a state of flux. And that generally means products either get into poorer quality, or supply lanes get lost, or management takes its eye off the ball while they get their house in order.
I guess I'm less worried about that. I can see why that could be a concern. But again, this is a head scratcher. We'll keep thinking about it and reading about it. And maybe we'll be talking about it again next week. And maybe Broadcom will buy somebody else next week. And we'll be like, what?
It's a fair chance. They've still got plenty of money. Like Qualcomm was $60 billion and they were ready to fund that. So this gets rid of some.
There could be two more coming. Who knows?
I've still got money left in my pocket money, Dad.
I've got to spend it.
Got to spend it.
All right, well, sticking with acquisitions, Intel has announced that it's going to acquire the chipmaker eASIC. This is a small company in Santa Clara. They didn't disclose how much they're going to buy it for, but it seems like it's not going to be material to Intel's bottom line. eASIC makes structured ASICs. They, I guess, sit somewhere between FPGAs and full ASICs, so they sort of split the difference between full programmability and the efficiency and capabilities of a hardwired, hard-coded ASIC.
Yeah, that's my reading of it as well. So Intel is a chip maker and a designer, which is kind of unique. There's a lot of companies who do chip design and a lot of companies who do chip manufacture, but not usually both. And Intel's quite unique in the fact that they do both of those. So they need to be continuing to acquire the next generation of designs. And they've made a few flubs, especially in the mobile space. So baseband modems, they didn't have any mobile CPUs in that are going into smartphones or tablets. So this looks like a step to get back into that market. So the eASIC looks a little bit like a set of designs where you can buy off-the-shelf silicon designs, which can be flexibly adapted into different shapes. And some of the products that they're talking about is you can use it as a crypto processor, an Ethernet, an NVMe, a PCI, a memory controller, a video encoder, and even as a microprocessor. But the actual software design is all pre-done, and then you just add some stuff into it like an app, and then you send it off to be manufactured. So instead of doing a full 2-year, 3-year cycle to get an ASIC off the ground, the company is claiming that 4 months to get an ASIC.
That's right.
You know, into production.
Yep. Essentially, you get an ASIC for a quarter of the time it would take to do a full blown.
Yeah. And there's companies out there who've taken the base design and then adapted it into each of these use cases that I just read out. So not a CPU as such, not a switching ASIC in the classic sense of the word, not as flexible as an FPGA because you can't just reload software into it, but somewhere in the middle. And the advantage, of course, of an ASIC like this is it's very low power. It would be fast because it's much closer and dedicated to what you want, whereas an FPGA tends to be power hungry because you've got a lot of stuff in there that's not doing anything useful.
Right. And given that low power that they're targeting 4 and 5G, they're targeting networking, they're targeting IoT. So it makes sense.
Yeah. There's a whole bunch of chips that need to go into smartphones and stuff like NVMe controllers to control DRAMs and SSDs.
Mm-hmm.
So interesting. It'll be interesting to see if Intel can make something of it, given they haven't been so successful in recent years with following the mobile transition.
All right, moving on. Light Reading has reported that the Vipela co-founder and CEO Atif Khan has a new startup. It's called Alkira. They've secured funding from VC giant Sequoia Capital and Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers. The startup also lured away several other Vipela executives and the other co-founder. They all went to Cisco after Cisco acquired Vipela in 2017. Now they're all putting the band back together on this new startup, Alkira.
Yeah, well, this is all scuttlebutt, but that's not going to stop us from speculating. But it is scuttlebutt. We said at the time when Vipela was acquired by Cisco is that a lot of employees were not locked in. Cisco didn't necessarily want all of them. And I pointed out at the time that Cisco felt that it could take the Vipela technology and do it itself from there. And I believe that Vipela has been quite successful inside of Cisco, and they're starting to bring out product, and people are giving me positive feedback about it so far, which is great, right? Good news. Well done to Cisco. But Cisco's got a hardware-dependent SD-WAN solution. So if I was going to make some predictions, I'm not going to be locked into these because I'm not real confident about this. My guess is that Cisco's not ready to do software-only solutions. Sure. It still wants to have that. It wants customers who are still safely and slowly moving. Yeah, that's right. Sell your box, get that revenue, and we'll give you some subscription revenue so you can have like half a cloud and have some software licensing. That's good for Cisco's business, and that's what they need to do for their shareholders. So I would guess that there's still plenty of room for companies doing a software-only networking strategy in the public cloud and giving you a private cloud, and they're just software. So there's no hardware or gateways or whatever.
I think that's a fair guess, given where Vipela came from and where the market is going. We should note that there is absolutely no information on Alkira's site about what they're going to do, what their plans are. About the only thing they tell you is that if you want to work for them, you can upload your resume, but they don't even say what positions they're looking for. You can just throw it into the bin and see what happens.
In other words, you have to know somebody to know what's going on.
Right.
Now, these the executives that they're talking about here are all Cisco veterans. So these people have all spent 10 to 15 years at Cisco before wandering off to the Vipela startup.
Or Juniper, other industry.
Yeah, Juniper. So they know the industry. So if they can come up with a working product that's got something to it, they can also go out and sell it because they've got contacts everywhere. So it would be someone to watch. And given that they've got funding from Sequoia and KPCB, they must have a good story.
Yes, and they've got a track record. They had that exit.
The track record's important, but they'd have to have a story or a product that they want to make or some sort of proof of concept. You know, they've backed into somebody else's project and they're just accelerating it. I would bet that they found somebody else's SD-WAN in prototype phase, and this team's come along and picked it up, and they're going to drive it into the market very fast. Classic Cisco style, you know, like the old spin-out, spin-in type stuff.
Yep. Well, we shall see. All right, a quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes helps organizations deliver business-critical service by providing performance visibility and actionable intelligence from every user over any network to every app, including Office 365 and Salesforce. They've got a distribution of vantage points from cloud agents, from enterprise agents, and now endpoint agents, so they can gather unique insights on network behavior, topologies, and how they affect application performance. You can get visualizations to break down complex performance issues across networks that you own and those that you don't. This can help you reduce troubleshooting time and pinpoint root causes. You can correlate multiple layers of performance data from layer 7 to layer 3 from BGP routing and DNS, so you can quickly identify problem areas and reduce your mean time to recovery. You can pinpoint root causes like device faults, congestion, Wi-Fi quality, DDoS attacks, and more. You can also share all this information on event dashboards. They've got metrics, they've got virtualization, so you can give that information to your partners, to your customers, to help you resolve problems faster. They've also got a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. You can sign up for a free account. That's at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. And while you're there, you can choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. ThousandEyes, thrive in a connected world.
I was using ThousandEyes this week. There was a big blog post wandering around the internet talking about a bunch of transit providers in Europe shutting down a Portuguese ISP. And this ISP has basically been taking BGP AS's and taking them for themselves and saying, instead of going and registering and paying the fees, they just take it. And then they go scanning around the internet looking for IPv4 addresses and then just advertising them as their own. If they're not being used, well, I'll use them. And
wow.
Then selling those IP address ranges to spammers. And so they all then, and that way they can sell them to spammers. And then they, when they get blacklisted, they turn them off for a while until the spam blacklist and then go off and again. Apparently this guy's been doing it for years, like 5 to 10 years, getting away with it. But this week, apparently, the community got together and attempted to shut the guy down. I'll put a link to the blog post in there, but you can go and look at all this and go look at all the ASs and see what this guy just announces stuff. Just absolutely right out there. Just absolutely something else. Yeah.
Boy. What a business model.
Yeah, well, you know, and he's going like, who, me? And they interviewed him. He goes like, I'm an honest businessman. And he's going like, but look at all this stuff that you do that's not very, and you're listed on all the spam providers. And he goes, that's not my fault. That's just my customers. It's like,
oh, man.
Yeah, but you've been doing it for 5 years. Well, what do I, you know, it wasn't me.
Oh, boy. Yeah, the link is in the show notes. Go check it out. All right, back to the news. Greg, you found a story about BP, that's British Petroleum. They're talking about their plans to bring more of their IT organization back in-house and cut off some of that outsourcing.
Yeah, it's a big story about their CIO who actually stood up and said it's no longer for strategic for us to not own. So we need to own, operate, and run our own infrastructure.
That's right. He said IT was strategic to their business, yeah.
Exactly. And it's like, hello. So it's very interesting to see a company of that size realize that IT is key to what they're doing. I don't think too many of them are actually doing this in public, standing up in public and saying, we messed up by doing outsourcing.
Right.
And of course, I've been a strong critic of traditional IT outsourcing, this idea of here's my infrastructure, which I can't operate myself. I'll give it to somebody else who can operate it better, which is kind of dumb because the infrastructure can't be operated. That's why you can't operate it. Don't know why giving it to somebody else would make it better, but you know, shift responsibility is sometimes a solution. So I'm going to take it as recognition of the fact that I've pretty much picked that trend right now. Outsourcing is alive and well if you consider SaaS providers are outsourcing. So companies like Salesforce and, you know, all that sort of stuff where you move the app into somebody else's environment, that's a different sort of outsourcing. You're not actually saying to people, operate the infrastructure that I own. You're actually saying, just give me a service.
Give me an application I need, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And if you think about outsourcing in terms of that, then outsourcing continues to grow very strongly in that. Is probably the most likely route to the public cloud. Internal or on-prem clouds will shrink as we see services move out. So things like email moving into Azure, of course, is the cheap and easy hit there. That's outsourcing, but that's not moving my Exchange server into somebody else's data center to operate my Exchange server for me and do the backups and, you know, do the storage and stuff like that. It's just like, here's my email, make it all work. And that's what outsourcing always should have been, but it never could be. So
the article did mention that he said they are going to look at cloud and software as a service options as well as part of this quote unquote digital transformation.
Yes. Well, you know, when you're talking at a CIO conference, you're going to have the word.
You have to say digital transformation. Otherwise, they won't let you in the door.
That's right. So I think it's as good a term as any to say, you know, we're actually taking computers seriously instead of regarding them as a cost. They're actually important. And having worked in several survey like oil exploration companies, I did some consulting into those. Companies like BP absolutely need to own that technology because it's critical. They can make substantial differences to their share price and their competitiveness by owning that technology in-house. Outsourcing to some third party to go and find the stuff for them doesn't work out in the long run. I don't think it aligns to the business closely enough.
Not at all. And that was exactly the point. Yeah, there's a quote in there that I loved where he said, He said, quote, we had become an IT organization which didn't really do IT. We facilitated other companies doing IT to us. That almost sounds punitive.
I feel that because I was either the person being done or the person doing it. I've worked on both sides of that for multiple organizations over the years, and I can promise you it literally is. It's an execution. Yep. Nobody wins in an outsourcing agreement where you might own your infrastructure but somebody else operates it. There's no winners there. Everybody loses. Yeah.
All right. I wanted to update you on the ongoing story about ZTE. If you recall, ZTE got into some trouble with the United States. And so the United States banned some essential product from being exported to ZTE. And so they essentially shut down operations. Now the U.S. Commerce Department has announced that it's going to allow these U.S. suppliers to begin selling to ZTE again, which will enable ZTE to restart its business operations. Those sales can start once ZTE deposits $400 million into an escrow account. That escrow account is sort of there as a threat. If ZTE starts to get up to monkey business again, the U.S. will take that money.
Yeah, not much to say here, I don't think. I think this is just the natural conclusion. You know, if you're going to throw out your entire board and CEO.
Yeah, as we reported last week.
To get access to a market, well, you would expect your quid pro quo to come home. So we'll see.
Yes. And then $400 million as a good behavior clause.
And this is the sort of silliness that's going to happen when you get into trade wars. I'm not sure where the winners are here.
Yeah, we'll see.
There's no money to follow. There's no winners or losers. There's no impact to enterprise IT per se yet. So I'm just going to let it fly right by.
All right, moving on. Dan Gooden, he writes at Ars Technica. He's reporting that there's a tech support scam going on that specifically targets Dell users. So you may have gotten a call from somebody saying, I'm calling from Microsoft about your Windows software. These scammers who are calling about Dell actually know the person's phone number, their name, they have their email, and they know the model and serial numbers of the PC the person owns.
Yeah, this seems you know, if you read the article, this seems like Dell's had a pretty serious breach of some sort.
A breach or a leak of something, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's either they got breached and somebody stole the data, or somebody inside took the data out and it's gotten into the public hands. But there's no question from, to my mind, from the description that's in the article, that somebody has an awful lot of personal details like your name, your address, the model number, the service number that's on the sticker underneath your laptop.
Right.
And if you're not a savvy person, or if you're a, you know, disorientated older person who had just bought a Dell PC to surf the internet to pay your bills or whatever, you could easily be duped here.
Yeah, for sure.
I think it's pretty clear that Dell got breached, and Dell should be owning up to this, in my opinion, but I'll bet you they aren't going to.
Well, Ars Technica did reach out to Dell to ask about the story, and Dell said, you know, essentially, we're working on it. They didn't fess up to anything bigger than that, other than to say it happens to everybody, which isn't, nobody else has had this issue with serial and model numbers, but essentially saying they're looking into it, and who knows what that means.
So the third bullet point I put here is my guess is that no one cares, and I doubt anybody gives a toss.
We'll see. It's not good for your customer service image to have people stealing money from your customers.
Yeah, but even explaining the breach, you know, like that somebody's going to ring you up and quote, isn't going to get airtime, and it's not going to affect Dell's share price, and it's not going to, people are still going to buy Dell's laptops for Windows PCs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that this actually, you know, they'll just pretend until people stop caring. It's going to be a flash in the pan in the news, and they're going to continue on their merry way. And I, even if they did own up to it, I don't think they will, because they're trying to list the company. We talked last week about trying to list on the stock exchange. You don't want to have that sort of thing going on.
No, you don't.
So, you know, we'll just hold it at arm's length and pretend it goes away.
Yeah, that's right. Close our eyes, ignore it, and it'll go away.
Maybe it'll go away if we ignore it for a few more weeks. But at the long run, I doubt anybody cares. Windows PCs have been vulnerable for 20 years. No one's bothered to fix them. Why would they start now?
You have a point.
Yeah.
I really don't have any argument for that.
So let's take a break here. I want to talk a little bit about Ignition. Ignition is the new membership system that Packet Pushers have put together. We're still producing the content. We wanted to get the membership system to get it started so that everybody could start to participate. You can sign up for free membership, and then you get access to the newsletters that we put out every week. We have a link propagation, which is a bunch of links that we curate. We collect them throughout the week, partly for network break and partly for what we write about and to keep informed in the industry. We then share those, curate them, and then send them out every Friday afternoon so you could read them up. We also have the Human Infrastructure Magazine and also what's happening in the latest blog post, latest podcast. If you're willing to pay for premium, then you could give us some financial support. Now, many people over the years have said, we'd love to help you financially. This is your opportunity. It's $100 a year to sign up for Ignition Premium Membership. And I'm just about to press publish on my career ebook. So the one thing that I've been asked more than anything over the last 8 years is career advice. People saying, I want help with my career. What should I be doing? Should I do this? Should I choose a service? And what I've done is distilled all of this into a 200-page, easy-to-read ebook. 200 pages, it's 20,000 words, so it's not really that long. You could read it in a few lunchtimes, really.
And there's lots of diagrams and artwork, too, so it's not all text.
Yeah, I did try to get some of those in there. It's part of the premium membership, and if you get it, I'm talking a little bit about what's changing in the industry and why your career is going to change, even if you don't know it is. I'm talking about how to understand modern recruitment. So we're seeing a transition away from the old ways of, you know, company advertisers in the local paper post in your resume to automated software. So there's an app called Google Hire. And I'm trying to give you some advice on how to cope with that, but not just how to apply, but how to emotionally handle being treated as a function in a machine, which is actually quite tough. And then also asking you questions about yourself and judging yourself. How do you measure yourself and your career value? So I've really tried to go fairly wide and full spectrum on your career here and distill down the dozens of podcasts we've done over the 600 or 700 podcasts we've done about career, you know, and the issues that we've done in career. I've had several people read it and add their commentary, and it's been reviewed. And it is also my hope to continue to develop the book. And if I need to, there'll be a part five. So if you become a premium member, you'll get access to that book and many more. I've got other content in the pipeline. I'm just completing something on why QoS sucks, so you can understand, and I'll explain for what looks like nearly 3 hours of why QoS sucks so bad. And then I've got another one in the pipeline, why routing is a mess, and explaining why I think routing is going to be, you know, all you've heard me go on with my hot button or my ranty issues. I'm going to stand up and put my thing on the line and explain why and how. But those are all coming in the months ahead. They take a lot of time to put together while we're producing four podcasts a week and running a business, but we're getting there.
Yeah, I just want to say that this premium membership, it's not just you tossing us some money because you like the work that we do. We give you something for it. There's actually content here in that exclusive tier. So it's not just a donation. It's you're getting something, hopefully, of value for that. So there's Greg's ebook. I just published a white paper on an SD-WAN survey we did with our audience. There are the newsletters, Greg said. There's videos from the virtual design clinic that we ran earlier this year and other things. So go check it out.
And I'm also producing videos as well. I'll publish one in the next week about the return of the campus. And this is just for premium members. It's a 20-minute video where I talk about the sudden resurgence of the campus networking in the enterprise IT and what I think about that. It's about 20 minutes of me yabbering at a camera.
More content if you want it.
Yeah, that's right. It really is a place for me to express myself where I can't do that unguarded in public because sometimes people get a little upset. But at this stage, what we'd like to say is if you've ever felt that we've helped you or been giving you some value, come and sign up, and then we're going to give you some more back, and then hopefully you'll sign up for the years to come.
Yep, so that's at ignition.packetpushers.net.
Yes, and it goes really fast now too.
Now, 20% faster.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. Sales of PCs are rising ever so slightly. This is according to market research from both Gartner and IDC. Gartner has pegged worldwide PC sales growing 1.4% versus this quarter 2017 is the first year-over-year growth in 6 years, according to Gartner. And then IDC says the PC market grew 2.7%, which is the highest growth rate it has tracked since 2012.
Yeah, because both of them said it, it must be true. Sometimes when you get them, you always question whether they just measured it wrong or something like that. So it does seem that PC sales have suddenly actually picked up a bit. What's interesting, I think, here is that Dell outgrew HP Inc., not HPE, HP Inc. So Dell's in this results from IDC, they said they had a 9% growth in the second quarter. Mm-hmm. HP had 7.6%. And Apple only had 0.1% growth in its shipments of boxes. So that's fairly interesting. Others shrank quite a bit. So I just think maybe we're seeing enterprise IT unlock their PC buying, maybe some more laptops. There hasn't been a lot of Intel CPUs out there that would drive a refresh. Windows 10 hasn't really been strongly taken up by vendors. So maybe we're just seeing sort of like a general sort of, all right, time to start unlocking the filing cabinet and getting some purchase orders cut for the new laptops.
Yeah, Gartner is attributing this growth to the business sector as opposed to the consumer sector. They're saying it's businesses that are responsible essentially for this uptick.
17.3 million units in a quarter. That's a lot of laptops.
Yeah.
Yeah. And desktops. It's astonishing. So the enterprise shift to Windows 10 and an overall positive economic environment helped to maintain momentum on the notebook side.
All right. So we're coming to our last story of the show. We sometimes call it surfing dog. We've been trying to decide of something different. I'm putting forward the last sip name for this. We'll see how that flies. Swirl it around your mouth, taste it, see if you like it or not. In any case, would you like to go into space? Now you can get a ticket to ride a Blue Origin rocket if you have $200,000 or $300,000 sitting around. That's according to Reuters. Reuters says Blue Origin, which is the space travel company formed by Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, is going to start taking passengers into space in 2019. And now rumors are floating around that the ticket price is going to be $200,000 to $300,000.
You know, and I'm worried about getting on a plane and people think that they want to get on a spaceship. That doesn't sound like the other thing about this is how many times have you seen these companies announce that they're going to do a flight to space and then never ever deliver it, like Virgin Galactic?
Yes, I believe Virgin Galactic may have even sold tickets, but they haven't taken anybody up yet.
Yes, color me dubious. Watching rich people play with toys and waste the money that they extorted from poor people just doesn't really make me all that happy. I'd be a lot happier if Jeff Bezos announced, with all the money that he's got available, that he was going to do something for society at the large.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my initial inclination is to sort of with that attitude that this is just some rich people farting around. But I also, growing up as a kid and reading science fiction and feeling like I was going to have a jetpack when I was older, yeah. I'm like, okay, we're taking baby steps there. We're a little bit like maybe someday if I had extra money, I could go into space.
I don't know. I doubt it. I was reading an article this week that apparently Seattle, the increase in homelessness and the poverty in Seattle is directly related to Amazon share price. The richer Amazon gets, the more poverty and the more society in Seattle degrades.
I mean, you can see that in San Francisco as well with the skyrocketing real estate prices. It's very hard to actually find affordable living in San Francisco. There was a story out, if you were making like $100,000, you were below the median income. So something outrageous where you're like, what?
Yes. Yes. And yes, I think we've talked about this before where, you know, I think to have a modest life in Silicon Valley, you would need to be earning $250,000 to $400,000.
Yes.
A year to have a modest middle-class life that you could have in other parts of the country, which is why so many people are moving out to Austin in Texas or Idaho or wherever it is, just not.
Cost of living is significantly different. Yeah.
Yep.
In any case, to round this up, if you happen to have an extra $300,000, that'll get you a trip that'll take you about 62 miles off the planet. You'll experience weightlessness for a few minutes, and then you'll come back.
Wow.
Left to you to decide if that's worth it.
Yeah, indeed.
All right, well, that wraps it up. Greg, what are your social coordinates?
You can find me blogging at packetpushers.net. I've been putting out a lot of Twitter au revoir this week because as I come across ideas as I'm writing my ebook. But Ignition is where I'm focusing my efforts for the next few weeks. But next week, I'm in Silicon Valley. If you're listening to this and you want to meet up, get in contact. I'm in Silicon Valley for next week and the week after. And I do have some spare meeting slots in San Francisco around the 26th and 27th. Of July, which is 2 weeks away. If you want to get together, get in touch. I'd love to have a coffee and have a chin wag.
All right. I'm Drew Connery Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM. I'm also blogging at packetpushers.net and writing for Ignition. Thank you to our sponsor, Thousand Eyes. And of course, thank you for joining us for yet another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, tell other people about it. Give us a recommendation on iTunes or share it with your friends. And of course, check out our membership program at ignition.packetpushers.net. And as always, thanks for listening.